Well, thank you for tuning in to What Is Either, episode 142 or episode 11, depending on how you look at it. My name is Matt Santos, and you are listening to The Mile High Show. I am doing a reboot, a reissue of episode number 11 from 2015, February 23rd, with Dan Fryhoe, who was the former fire chief in Prescott, Arizona, very close to where I live and pretty much where this podcast is based. At the time, in February 15, we were going through a mayoral race in Prescott, and Chief Fryhoe was one of the candidates, and he did not he did not get that seat of mayor when the election came. But in the course of the campaigning, we did sit down with him because I wanted to pick his brain a little bit. But that was just a small portion of why I sat down with the chief. One of the primary reasons to do so was because he was at the helm of the fire department in Prescott just about a year and a half previous to that, in June 30th of 2013. That was the fateful day, the tragic day, when our community lost 19 young firefighters. The Granite Mountain Hotshots, where the entire crew minus one, Brandon McDonough, was lost up on that hill in Yarnell, Arizona. 19 young men lost their lives that day. It was the largest firefighting disaster in the nation. It was a horrible day for this area, not just because 19 young men were lost, but because this is such a small community in an area that is prone to wildfires and such a rich history in the Old West that these were not just firefighters that were lost. These were friends, they were family, they were sons, they were brothers, fathers, and husbands, and they were our neighbors, they were our friends, and we lost them that day. I personally knew a few of these guys fairly close, one in particular very close. I was very tight with his, and still is with his family. They actually live about 100 yards from my front door. So this was a June 30th of 2013 was a horrible day. And that is 4 years ago yesterday. So one of the reasons I wanted to reissue this is because it is the memorial, the anniversary of the death of those 19 as of yesterday. It was celebrated at the, around the state and around the area, but primarily at the Courthouse Square in Prescott yesterday at, I believe it was 4:42, the time of that last call. So I wanted the listeners to be reminded of what this community went through and what these young men meant to our community. And by doing so, reissuing this episode with Dan Fryhoe. And there again, it's going to start with me butchering his name like I just did. So bear with me because I'm an idiot. But let's listen in to Chief Dan and listen about his history. And again, we do talk pretty extensively about that day in 2013. So again, wanted to put that out on the forefront. This is a reissue in remembrance of that day that we lost the Yarnell 19. One of the reasons it's so fresh in everybody's mind, of course, is the anniversary date, but also because this community right now, as I'm speaking, is in the midst of hopefully the tail end of battling the Goodwin Fire, where I believe just south of Prescott in the Mayor Dewey area, this fire, the Goodwin Fire, reached upwards of 24,000 acres in a matter of 2 or 3 days. There was, I believe, over 1,400 firefighters from around the state, around the Southwest, battling that fire. Homes were evacuated. People were sheltered, and now their highways were closed. Now, in the last 24, 36 hours, some of those folks have been allowed to go back home, but there are still still many hundreds impacted by this fire. And of course, the entire community, the Quad Cinco City area, however you want to view it, is pulling together in support of not only the firefighters, but those folks, our friends and neighbors who have been evacuated and displaced from their homes. So that drums up all these feelings again and all this remembrance of the Arnell 19. So without further ado, let's plug into February 23rd, 2015 with Dan Freihoe, the former chief of the fire department in Prescott and former mayoral candidate and still to this day pillar of our community. And take a chance, please, if you would, and Google Yarnell 19, Google Granite Mountain Hotshots, click on that link in the show notes and refresh your mind with what this community, this county, this state, this country lost 4 years ago last night. We're set to go.
Okay.
Thanks, Dan, for meeting with us. Now, the very first question.
Uh-huh.
The very first question. I have pronounced it Freihoe, Freihoe.
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 Freihoe, yeah.
Freihoe.
Yes.
So I have gotten that wrong on my intro that I did today. I think, actually, I may have bounced back and forth.
I was introduced today as Freihoe. So,
Freihoe?
Yeah. So, no, it is Freihoe.
Now, just give us the Reader's Digest kind of 90-second bio on your... You growing up, where was home for the Freihoe family?
I was born in Superior, Arizona, and our family goes back to about 1893, actually. I was raised in the Phoenix area. I was educated there, and eventually I had three daughters. And once I got retired from the Phoenix Fire Department, then I went looking for fire chief jobs, and I have been all over the western United States.
Wow.
Boise, Idaho, Washington. My last job was in San Francisco as the chief of staff and deputy director for emergency communications.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's kind of my old stomping grounds.
Yeah.
I was born and raised in the East Bay, south of Oakland, Hayward.
Oh, okay.
Where I was.
Yeah.
Where I, where'd you go to school? Where'd you go to high school?
Camelback High School.
Camelback
High School.
Was fire services, was that something you wanted to do
actually,
when
no.
you were growing up?
No, actually it wasn't. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. I was coaching Pop Warner football at the time, and two guys that were the fathers of two of the players came up to me, and they asked me if I thought I'd be interested in getting on the fire department. And so I said, why not? I was in construction at the time.
Yeah.
Just taking a few classes at Phoenix College. They were fire captains for the Phoenix Fire Department. And there I go. That started a new career. You know, I wasn't one of these guys that chased fire trucks or anything like that. It's just an opportunity.
It wasn't in the... What did Dad do? What did your dad do?
He was a cement contractor.
Okay, so yeah. In the trades.
Yes, right.
Uh-huh. Is that what got you into the trades? Just being around the building and
actually,
things like
yes.
that?
Actually, yes. I was working at the time. I was working for him and going to school. And, of course, once I got on the fire department, then I was very limited on my side work.
Uh-huh. In this area, I've found in working through media with a lot of the local firemen, it's a family business. There's brothers and sons and fathers that you see the same names in a lot of the departments here locally. And I was just wondering, it seems to work that way. But you were a trailblazer for your family, huh?
I was. Yeah. However, I do have a nephew, same name. Daniel. He goes by Daniel. I go by Dan. He's with Phoenix Fire Department. He's been there about 7 years now. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You guys can slide over if you want. If you no, they don't want to be near us. They don't want to besmirch your name.
They keep making faces.
No, that's Bob's normal face. So what? We got a couple people watching us record here. Oh, and thank you to Starbucks for letting us come in here over Frontier Village. I guess I shouldn't thank them because I really didn't ask. So they may be running us out of here any minute now. So you spent, how long were you with Phoenix?
20 years.
20 years.
20 years, that's correct, yes.
What was there anything that you specialized in? Was it, or did you just do everything within the department? Did you concentrate on medical, or was it structural, or what were your duties with the fire?
Well, district? I started as a firefighter, like most people do, and but at one point I took a very strong interest in emergency medical services. It was just brand new. Emergency medical technician was a brand new thing that was starting, and I had a lot of interest in it, and so. Once I got some education, and then I started coordinating some of the activities with some of the other fire personnel and things like that. And pretty soon, it eventually became something that was interesting enough by the administration to start what is now called paramedics there.
Yeah.
And so I was instrumental.
That was an infancy situation of that program,
correct.
Huh?
It just started in California. And so I was involved with that. We got the first paramedic program started.
What years are we talking about?
I started the fire department in 1965.
Oh, wow.
So this was in the early 70s that we got the paramedic program. But I was also promoting myself through the ranks. So I did make it to division chief, but I was in operations, I was in training, I was in admin, and I was also the liaison to to all the aviation department for Phoenix, and plus I was a district manager for the city as a division chief.
Wow, so you got the nuts and bolts, boots on the ground training, and also the admin office administrator kind of things that you saw as a chief as well.
That's correct. Pretty much did everything that you could do as a firefighter.
From the time that you started in the mid-late 60s up through, what were some of the big changes you saw, just not so much with the fire service, but just in Phoenix in general? Because mm-hmm. that a big growth for Phoenix, if I'm not mistaken. I'm new to Arizona, 10
uh-huh.
years.
Uh-huh.
But there was a pretty good boom in the late 70s and again 90s that saw a lot of influx of people and industry.
Uh-huh.
What were some of the big things that stuck out that sit in your memory for the changes to the Phoenix? And
there was a tremendous amount of growth, but I think that jumps out at me the most is that the road systems did not work for the growth. It was years later before freeways were put in. The only freeway at that time was the one that goes from Tucson to Flagstaff, I-17.
Yeah.
I-10 becomes I-17. Probably the biggest thing that jumps out at me, and this will go back more so to the fire department necessarily than the city, is that we were very progressive at that time. It was one of those situations where we could see that the fire service had to start doing things differently. Paramedic was one thing that we talked about. Hazardous materials, technical rescues, all those things that you see now, we started flirting with those ideas, or we developed those ideas at the time. And so it was a very progressive department at that time. And a lot of the departments throughout the country have also gone in that direction because we realize that productivity is based on activity.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest thing that's carried me forward as a fire chief. I've always felt that way. It's one of these things, if it's not broken, you're not looking hard enough.
Yeah.
And so I always wanted to strive to do things better, hopefully, and in some cases they worked out very well.
Yeah. Now what, you went through, where'd you say, Idaho?
Boise, Idaho was my first fire chief job.
That was your first chief. How big of a department was that?
There was about close to 200,000 people, and we had 10 fire stations at the time.
Yeah. Wow.
However, Salinas was actually the California was
Salinas, California
was the first time that when I left Phoenix, I was equivalent to about a deputy chief in Salinas for several years. As a matter of fact, I was in charge of the city when the earth, what they call the World Series earthquake.
Yeah,
took place.
Loma Prieta.
Yeah,
I was up in Oakland.
Okay.
During that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know what that was like.
I pulled up to the Cypress structure just maybe 200 yards in front of some of the first fire trucks that were getting there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I was freelancing for a paper there.
Okay.
And, Salinas, how hard did Salinas get hit?
Well,
I know Santa Cruz was a huge impact.
Yes, Santa Cruz, Watsonville, Salinas, Hollister, all those cities sustained a lot more damage proportionately than San Francisco did, but of course San Francisco was the one that got the most notoriety.
The media was already there.
That's correct.
And then the population, too.
The population, plus there was a spectacular fire there, too.
The
density,
the PG&E lines that burst
right,
and caused
exactly.
the fire, yeah.
So, yeah. But for the first 24 hours, we were without, well, actually for 3 days, we were without all power.
Yeah.
And the first 24 hours, I was one of the only persons there at the incident management, at the command post, so to speak.
So you're no stranger to large incidents.
Oh, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I think I've been an incident commander to everything but a hurricane. Yeah, yeah. I hope I never am.
Well, global warming, global climate change, whatever. Al Gore may throw one at you soon.
Believe it or not, we even had a tornado in the Phoenix area there, right around Camelback Mountain. Yeah, yeah.
Man. Mm-hmm. Now, I spent, like I said, most of my years, born and raised in Hayward, smack dab between Oakland and San Jose.
Uh-huh.
Actually, the Hayward fault line ran right through the hillside, so there were some parks. And Hayward High School, mm-hmm. you could see the little crevice mm-hmm. going behind the campus. Mm-hmm. But I bounced around in there after high school in the East Bay. And just before moving to Arizona, mm-hmm. I spent 2 years, my wife and I, in Gilroy.
Oh, yes.
So I was working in San Jose, but living in Gilroy, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And that little stretch of highway between Gilroy and Hollister into Salinas mm-hmm. was a neat little spot. Laguna Seca, you mm-hmm. had to pass through mm-hmm. there. Neat area, but not the Phoenix Metro. Would you compare it? How would you compare, say, Salinas as far as demographics and age and things to Prescott?
Well, of course, Prescott's an older city, but the demographics in Salinas were very, very diverse because actually Salinas became three communities that merged together. The LSL, what they call North Salinas, which was Old Salinas, and then the newer part of Salinas. So there was a time in history when the Grapes of Wrath era was there in the LSL. And so you had very diverse, not only almost boundaries, but different types of people.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The economic shift, because Prescott area is deep, deep agriculture, farming, ranching.
Salinas.
No, in Prescott. Oh, it's pretty deep on there. Uh-huh. And then you also have the influx of the retired community.
That's correct.
And folks who have moved here from the colder climates of the Midwest and from Southern Cal.
Yeah, yeah.
Salinas was pretty stark in difference between the ag. Dole had their processing plants close by. Gilroy, of course, fed into there.
Mm-hmm.
Some ranching and things, but then a lot, pretty heavy industrial as well. And didn't they feed off of military as well out of Monterey?
Not as much. Later, after I left, I understand that it became very important because once they closed Fort Ord, that became then kind of the nucleus for people to buy. But to compare Prescott to Salinas, there's really no comparison.
Not much in
any way.
Huh, yeah, interesting. Yeah. Uh-huh. There was a couple neat areas of Salinas I remember seeing where it was kind of like the older downtown.
Uh-huh.
Some nice restaurants and
yes.
some really neat Art Deco buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And then two blocks away, you're in an area. Now, I lived for a time in West Oakland right off of High Street and San Leandro Boulevard, which was not a very desirable area. And there were parts of Salinas I wouldn't drive through at night. It was pretty rough. It had a very,
very diverse,
good, very big mix. Yeah,
it's almost mix. From across the street from each other. Yes, absolutely.
It was an interesting area, but a neat spot.
It is. Yeah. It's close to Monterey and some of that area, and close to San Jose, and certainly close to San Francisco. So we spent a lot of time throughout that entire area and just really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Now, how long were you there?
I was there about 3.5 years. Then I got the Boise Fire Chief job.
Now, what brought you, let's bring it back to where you are now, what brought you to Prescott?
Well, Arizona was where we were going to end up.
Coming back home.
Actually, my wife played a big part in it because I met her in California. Actually, I went to Fresno for a fire chief's training conference, and there was this pretty smile over across the room, and being the person I am, I went over and tried to introduce myself and eventually did. And so when we got married, for her to come to Arizona and see more of my family, we started in Havasu, Flagstaff, Prescott, and then Phoenix. And she fell in love with Prescott.
Nice.
And it was always her desire that we move, come back to Arizona, that we live in Prescott. So,
So can we add ladies' man to your resume? I'm sorry if I'm distracted. I glance down at my recorder because I have this fear that I haven't pressed the right buttons.
No.
So put a camera in my hand and I'm comfortable. Give me these recorders and I'm second guessing myself all the time. So when did you end up back in Prescott? What time?
Almost 13 years ago. Yes.
Wow.
Right.
And what were your duties? When you came back to the Prescott Fire Department?
Actually, I retired from San Francisco. Yeah. I did what I had to do there, got it over with, and I helped them put the emergency communication system in place. Not as a technician, but as an administrator.
Administrator. Yeah. Let's backtrack a little bit. Sure. Talk a little bit more about your time in San Francisco.
Well, I was recruited to go there. When I was in Vancouver, Washington, I consolidated two large fire departments. And the person that was in charge of communications in Clark County was hired in San Francisco. And she wanted me to go over and help because they were going to consolidate fire, police, and EMS into one communications building, one system. And there was a lot of problems, a lot of individual problems and department competition, just yeah. some of those sorts of things that happen in older big cities. And so she asked me if I would join her. And that's how I ended up over there. My job at that time was going to be the chief of staff, which basically running all the operations. But when the person that was actually started the 911 project mm-hmm. left, she asked me to take over.
So you were dealing with a newcomer to the area, yes. dealing with folks who and departments who had been in place for decades and more.
Yeah. And plus, it's a strong mayor form of government.
Yes.
And San Francisco is a county and a city also.
Yes. Yeah. The entire city limits are also the county of San Francisco.
Yeah. So yeah. you're dealing with very, very old politics, very, very old ways of doing business, very entrenched systems, very strong unions.
Mayors of San Francisco have, in my memory, have always been personalities into their own. They have been pseudo-celebrities, kind of. So you're right that mayor's office in San Francisco has always been a force, similar to but not at the scale of New York and L.A. and things like that, where everybody knew who the mayors were. Mm-hmm. They were constantly in the spotlight
yes.
and in the camera's lens.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah,
so. Well, you know, and you might want to compare them not in size to New York or Los Angeles, because the notoriety that San Francisco gets is right there with the
yeah,
rest of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's always something
they
going on over there.
They just don't have the
there.
Budgets
yes,
of New
yeah.
York.
Yeah, they're not as big, but it is a very complex political system.
So what were some of the challenges you faced in getting all those personalities, those departments, and those traditions? They all had their own traditions to work together at a common goal with 911 and mm-hmm. and the emergency communications. What were some of the things that you had to deal with?
One of the more important things was to get the dispatchers, call takers, and those people that are actually manning the emergency services system all cross-trained. So there was no territoriality between what a fire dispatcher might do one day and a police dispatcher might do another way. Plus, we instituted something that's called Clausen Protocols, which is basically a checklist of questions you ask under emergency medical conditions. The biggest issue there was not so much the emergency communications or the emergency communication system or the personnel. The biggest problem there was getting police, fire, and EMS to work, or especially fire and EMS to work together. That was the biggest issue because they were separate departments at the time. And so one went one way, one went the other way. And when you started mixing them and mixing their functions, then it became yeah. somewhat of a different animal, so to speak.
And when you left there after how many years?
About 3 years.
How was it viewed? How was that project viewed? Were you able to accomplish the goals that you set out?
I did finish the 911 project, and then shortly after that, I did leave. So I wasn't there for that okay. total consolidation. In San Francisco, it's not unusual for a department head to leave, and then the number two person either move up or yeah. move out. Yeah. And so the department head did go to Los Angeles, and I opted to take a retirement.
Is that a way for the incoming head to kind of have some more...
It can
not control, but familiarity and bringing their own staff kind of things.
In certain respects, you can say that. In certain respects, you can say that there's a spoil system involved there, too.
Yeah.
In a strong mayor form of government, the mayor is a CEO,
yeah.
and he hires and fires. In a city manager form of government, the city manager hires and fires, and the mayor doesn't have those responsibilities.
Yeah.
So there, in the strong mayor form of government, there's an enormous amount of political power
yeah.
that's behind that seat.
Yeah. So you retired, ended
yes.
up in Prescott?
Yeah, I moved here.
And we spend your days fishing and hunting? What was your retirement?
Well, my wife stayed in San Francisco for another few years. I did we did buy one house, and then we sold that and bought another one, and I spent a lot of the time with the remodeling of the second house.
Getting your hammer back in shape and your construction form back?
Proving how little I know about that stuff. And so that was part of it until I got the call as far as the interim position with the fire department.
And when was that? What year was that?
That was in 2012, yeah.
No, winter, wasn't it? It was February or something?
No, actually, I think it was in May. April okay. or May. April. I think it was the end of April, and I started in May.
Of 12.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the atmosphere with Prescott Fire when you came in as interim?
Well, according to the city manager, there was a great deal of problems that they were dealing with. Some of them were becoming political problems because the rank and file were very upset about what was happening with the department and their lack of participation in some of those important areas that they wanted to participate in. And they felt like they were being disrespected and being left out. And so when he talked to me, what he wanted me to do was get in there and try to calm things down. That's basically what he asked me to do.
Now, how long did that interim position last before it became permanent official?
About 9 months. Yeah.
I think that's what I pulled up was when you were appointed it like the winter?
It was February.
February of 13?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you and your name and your face came to the forefront statewide outside of the fire service. You know, obviously your time and your accomplishments, your resume, obviously had a name for you within the industry, within the services. But as far as the general public, even nationwide and internationally, of course, came to the forefront on June 30th of 2013.
That's correct.
13. I had crossed your path on occasion before that at various functions and events, but right following the Dosey Fire, which was, the 10th, 8th, 9th, 10th, something like that of June?
2 weeks prior to the, yes, sir.
That was as I was exiting out of, I was within my 2 weeks notice of leaving the paper as a full-time employee. And as we all watched the news and interviewed and photographed and recorded folks whose homes were in the line of the Dosey Fire, mm-hmm. I remember sitting out at Outer Loop Road there at the gas station there next to the, I think that's a Central, is that a Central?
Yes.
Central Yavapai mm-hmm. Fire Station right mm-hmm. there on Outer Loop and Williamson Valley, interviewing and talking with some of the folks who were watching this orange glow come over Granite Mountain mm-hmm. and come dangerously close, too close for comfort to their homes. As that fire started getting contained, it really brought our community together, mm-hmm. all of our whole Quad City area, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. in a sigh of relief that the damage wasn't as bad as it definitely could have been.
Correct. Uh-huh.
Within days, Yarnell Hill sparks, I believe the 28th of June, mm-hmm. 27th, 28th. Mm-hmm. What started that fire? Was it weather related?
It's my understanding it was.
Has that been determined?
Yes. I think it has. I think it was weather-related. If I'm not mistaken, it was lightning. However, I was not involved with that.
Other side of the hill.
Correct.
Uh-huh. But when that happened, I believe it was either Thursday or Friday when news came out, and people were just getting their breath back mm-hmm. from Dosey.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of took, I don't want to say backseat, but kind of. It mm-hmm. wasn't as big a concern or a deal. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was to the folks in Yarnell at the mm-hmm. time. But, mm-hmm. but it was kind of a sleepy weekend. And I remember Sunday afternoon on the 30th. In my years working local media, I've developed relationships with several firefighters mm-hmm. and some of the PIOs and that. And I got a couple of texts, nothing specific, but from folks within some of the agencies,
mm-hmm.
hey, something bad happened, and we didn't get details.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started getting some calls, hey, did you hear what's going on in Yarnell?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, I'm getting texts. This goes on for a couple hours. And then I jumped on social media,
mm-hmm.
and I started seeing some posts from concerned friends and mm-hmm. family members, mm-hmm. some names mentioned, and nothing confirmed. And then I get word that there will be a press conference that evening at in Prescott, outside of a town mm-hmm. building, and myself and a couple dozen others are mm-hmm. out there.
Mm-hmm.
Lights, bright lights, a podium, and a microphone. And then you step out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Wade was to your, trying to remember the
my
pictures,
right.
To your
right.
Yeah. As you're walking out of that building, what's going through your mind? And I know this is tough.
Matt, I had no idea exactly what I was going to say. That's something I don't think you can rehearse for.
Good evening. My name is Dan Fryholm, fire chief in Prescott, Arizona, and I have some very, very distressing news. Circumstances that I'm not aware of or have not been informed of yet, our entire crew was lost. We lost 19 people in this wildfire. It's one of the worst wildfire disasters that's ever taken place. Hopefully we'll have more information for you, but right now what we do know is that 19 firefighters were killed but probably the worst disaster that's taken place in wildland history here in the state of Arizona. We grieve for the families, we grieve for the department, we grieve for the city, and that's all the information I really have.
The impact of that magnitude is absolutely, and we keep using words like devastating, but that's exactly what it is. For something that's that huge. Now, I knew by the time I went up there, I had some of the information. I didn't have all the information.
So you were still getting updates?
Well, I started getting updates as soon as they couldn't find them. I was on top. We were working several fires here in town and over on P Mountain.
Yes.
I was up there with the incident commander. That was the last bigger fire that we had during that day when I got the first telephone call that 19 of our people are unaccounted for. And then the shelters had been deployed. And shelter deployment is maybe a 50-50 chance when you're out in the wild like that. And then a long time passed, and we didn't hear anything. And then finally we got information that that they had found the bodies. In the time it took me to start making the notifications and those sorts of things, it was like I had to switch gears.
Yeah.
It was. There's the emotional side, and then there's the professional side, if you will. And there was a lot of things to do. Part of the problem, and I think that you recognize this when you started getting calls, speculating on what may have happened, is the mass media is so efficient that there was word getting out there before we even knew the details. And
yeah.
Part of it started when they called the dispatch and they wanted to alert every hospital in the area to have as much plasma as possible. And anybody knows that plasma is the first line of defense for burns. And then the family started hearing this before we could notify them.
Yeah.
We wanted to notify them individually with somebody that could be there to support and somebody that could be there to communicate. And so basically we lost a lot of control by the time, yeah. even by the time that I was talking to the media. And all I could do was say what I knew and speak from the heart. That was it. So it was very spontaneous. It wasn't lengthy. I did want them to respect the families. I did want them to be as accommodating as possible.
Yeah.
I had no idea the magnitude of the extent of the injuries and deaths that had taken place until later. It was absolute carnage. And that is basically what I was dealing with when yeah. I went to talk to the media.
And I'm probably getting it wrong, but there's folks that, you know, we hear it, the definition of a hero is somebody who runs towards danger while the rest of us are running away from it.
Mm.
That's the life of a firefighter. It's a life that you've been involved with for your adult life. Are you ever fully prepared for the death of a fellow firefighter?
In certain respects, it's always back there. In my career with Phoenix, we lost five people. And but it's always there, that possibility. Yeah. We try to be as safe as possible. We try to do all those things, but sometimes, whether it's by error, whether it's by accident, which was unforeseen, whatever the case might be, things like this do happen. Yeah. I would venture to say that any of those good men that were killed would not say that they were heroes, despite what anybody says, because they're doing what they love. Yeah. They were trained to do it. It's just a terribly sad situation what happened to them. But my feeling is that when you engage in something like that, you know what the risks yeah. are. Just don't make any sacrifices. You're not really ever prepared for something like that, because the reaction is going to be the same every time you hear it. At least it has with me.
In the course of the following 72 and plus hours, the next few days and a week after that initial press conference Sunday night, we all saw a flood of attention to the area, media, satellite trucks pulling up, people descending, residents and neighboring communities kind of descending on the courthouse square. For many of those folks, not the media, but the general public, they kind of just came because they didn't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
Describe your 72 hours after that Sunday night. What were some of the things that you, as chief, had to do? Because you still have a department to run.
Exactly.
You still have a job.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this becomes a focal point. But what was that week like for you?
Well, the next day, what we had to do was to set up an incident management system that could take care of what we knew was going to be the magnitude of this problem. Because not only did we have funerals to deal with, we had families to deal with, we had a memorial to deal with, and we found some of the best incident management teams in the United States to help us, and they came immediately. Yeah. So that was the first thing. An incident management team works on objectives. You give them objectives, yeah. and then you let them do their job. So thank goodness I could do that. My job was to put the department back together as soon as I could, and the fact that it was so devastated, we got an incredible amount of help from fire departments all over the state. So we still had to facilitate them being here.
Had a fire to put out.
Yarnell, no, we're out of that altogether. The only relationship...
Well, I mean, just in general, the firefighters that were, you know, that was still going on.
In Yarnell.
Yeah, in Yarnell.
Yeah, no, once this happened, we were completely out of Yarnell.
Okay.
Yeah, that was 30 miles away, so
yeah.
that was taken care of by others. The 72 hours was just an absolute trauma of activity, questions, decisions, things like that. The incident management team did an outstanding job. Now, consider this, that you had Prescott City, you had the National Forest, you had the federal government in other areas, you had firefighters from all over the country, and the hotshot at the state level. All of these people had a vested interest in the outcome.
Yeah.
We had to bring all of those agencies together at some point to fulfill a common goal. But the storming process that first brought them together was almost nil. That's how it good. And there was never a time... If there was any kind of a disagreement, there was never a time that I got involved that whatever I said was the final word.
Yeah.
It was never argued. That's how cooperative everybody was.
And to get that many agencies together, it's almost unheard of. So
well, at the largest part of the command post, where there was 240 people working it, everybody had an individual job, one way or the other. The logistics was enormous.
Yeah. As the impact started to settle in a little bit, the community again deeply affected. These were guys that were friends, neighbors, brothers, sons. Several of them I knew well. A couple of them I was very close with, and their family, their families. The impromptu memorials started to be set up, mm-hmm. the gatherings, the funerals started to happen, leading up to the very large memorial service that was held at the then Tim's Toyota Center, now mm-hmm. the Prescott Valley Event Center. How was that handled? Was it, did you have much input on that, or did you just know what time to be there and where to go? How involved were you in the planning and execution of that memorial service?
Actually, very little, because like I said, if you bring the right professionals together and tell them what you want, they'll get it done, yeah. and that's exactly what they did. My involvement up to that point basically was to break any ties, to be visible, to be... whoever called and asked for an interview, I did it no matter yeah. what, and anywhere. You know, I became the face and the voice because yeah. nobody else would do it.
And that brings up my next question. As much time that you did have answering questions, giving your perspective and giving updates, is there anything still that you haven't had an opportunity to say or to express about that tragic Sunday?
Well, there's I wish that the city of Prescott would have become more involved. I do. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I wish they would have become more involved. Not only would it have been an easier process to deal with having support or feeling like you have support, but also there were some decisions that only the city should be making. I've always maintained that when there's a leadership vacuum, leaders will emerge.
Yeah.
And so consequently, there seemed to be a vacuum there. And
that didn't get filled, in your opinion.
I filled it.
Yeah.
I filled it. And yes. and so that created some of the problems. And then eventually, I think that I became so familiar, and the fact that I will always give an interview, that it was easier for people to call me than to call anybody else.
Yeah.
And I think there was a time when the city was wanting to take more control, but the media was going to me or coming to me.
Yeah.
And so I think that may have created some of the problems.
Think you stepped on some toes? Or
not
did people feel that you stepped on toes?
I don't know. I was never given an explanation.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunate for the families and those involved and for the community in general, very soon after that, people were looking for somebody or something to blame. Finger-pointing mm-hmm. started to happen. There was a report that came through, and you'll have to refresh me on this. I was reviewing a lot of documents today, some mm-hmm. of the printouts and that, mm-hmm. and I got to the point where, one, some of it was obviously still in my brain, mm-hmm. in my memory, mm-hmm. some of it was a little new to me. Some of it just refreshed. And mm-hmm. I started to go one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I wanted this conversation to be organic.
So right.
I kind of stopped reading, to be honest with yeah. you. But there was a report that came out that quoted an individual. Was it from the U.S. Forestry? It was somebody who decided to point to blame.
Yes.
That was not, and the quote you had on one of the television news reports was this was somebody who wasn't involved in the investigation.
Correct.
And you don't know where that information had come from that they formed their opinion. Give us a little bit about that.
Well, it was some very, very frank and statements that had no basis in fact. It was based on opinions and experiences by an individual, and as I recall, he was a retired individual from the Forest Service, and I thought it was very, very improper for him to be making statements such as that, and the fact that there wasn't a total investigation that had taken place, and knowing that we might never know what the facts are and how it affected the families was very disturbing to me. So I was very aggressive about addressing that.
Certain aspects of any incident, this one specifically because of where it was located, the remoteness of the area, certain questions can only be answered by, correct me if I'm wrong, by the people who were there, and unfortunately those people are no longer with
us. That's exactly right.
So as media does, they always have, anytime there is an incident, an event they will reach out to people as so-called, and I'm doing the quote-unquote expert witnesses, whether it be a high-profile legal case, the OJ cases of the world. They'll get a hold of a lawyer to say, well, how would you handle this? How is that kind of what this was? Did they reach out? Did the media reach out to a fire expert to offer their opinion? Is that
That part I don't know. I do know that they their job is to get a story, and sometimes the people that have the information either can't or won't give the information. Yeah. And so they either hedge or it's a no comment or whatever the case might be, which might be the smarter thing to do. But when you folks have a job to do, you're going to start looking for the human interest if you can't find the facts.
Just talking about you.
And sometimes the human interest is very opinionated.
Yeah, yeah.
So
now, you're over the next few months, we saw your exit out of the city of Prescott. I believe it was November.
Yes.
What? Again, I read a little bit quotes on both sides. The official term for the official statement out of the city of Prescott was it was a mutual agreement. Some of the quotes I read from you at the time were that it was only mutual on one side. Is that safe to say?
Oh, it's definitely safe
okay,
to say.
Okay, give me your take.
Well,
what all happened?
It was a situation where I can't tell you all the details from the other side simply because I never got them. But there was a point in time when there was just no communication was taking place between city management and myself. And then one of the deputy city manager at one point told me that they felt that it was me not communicating. Well, I'm a communicator.
Yeah.
So I immediately set up a meeting, and I went to talk to the city manager, and I told him, I prefaced it at the time that...
McConnell?
Yes. I prefaced it at the time of we got to start working on this stuff. We got to start figuring out what has to be done, because I knew that there was going to be budget impacts, and you don't budget for something like this, but you certainly have to deal with it. And so basically the last question I asked was, how can we communicate better? And his response to me, and quite frankly, was just this specific. He said, well, man to man, I want you to re-retire. And my response to that was, okay, I came to communicate, and you want me to leave. And he hawed a little bit and said certain things, but the answer was yes. And I told him at the time, and I told him way before, because I turned this job down twice before I was offered the job.
Yeah.
I told him, I'll stay as long as you want me to. And if you want me to leave, I'm gone. And that's the way it was. But the last words I said was, but remember, this is your idea, not mine.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned a few moments ago that there were things that the city could have and should have done, and there was a void, there was a vacuum that you needed to step in and fill. Let's put on our Monday morning quarterback helmet on. You're given full authority. You're in charge. What are some of the things that the city of Prescott could have done in the ensuing days, weeks, months following the Arnell Hill fire?
Participated from the first. That's so the most.
In what ways? What are some of those?
Well, they had to be involved. When you have an incident management team, you have representatives from all agencies. In this case, I mentioned the five big ones that were involved. City of Prescott was enormous. That was the biggest agency, because those were people that worked for the city of Prescott. And I can only speculate this part is that there was so much maybe inexperience with dealing with something of that magnitude. It just kind of shut down. It shut down, but yet I think there was a desire to be in charge. But there wasn't the attempt to take charge where it could happen. And so my suspicion is that as they were trying to take control, it wasn't by getting involved. It was trying to control from a distance, if you will.
Gotcha. Why do you think that is? You think it was a matter of financial liability or what?
No, I really don't know.
You don't
see that? That's never been explained. I can only speculate on that. Sometimes when things get really tense, some people run toward it and some people run away from it.
Yeah.
So
your this conversation you had with McConnell, where he requested your retirement. Mm-hmm. When was that in relation to your last day?
Actually, it was in October that it took place. The agreement that I had was that I would be gone in 30 days. But we also agreed that it would be very, very difficult and very awkward to be there. So
in the interim.
Yeah. So 30 days later is when it was officially, when it was official.
Okay. And what this might be way too broad of a question, but what was your mental and emotional state during those 30 days?
Well, I have been politically assassinated in my jobs twice. And I've had extremely difficult situations dealing with unions. And so something like this to happen is really something that you can't prepare for because you've experienced it. It did not surprise me what happened. It was one of those situations that I could look at myself in the mirror and say, you gave it your best shot. It just wasn't going to work. Styles, to me, are we create more conflict than issues. If your management style is something that's different from mine, then therefore you are wrong. And I can tell you right now, or I am wrong, and I can tell you right now that my style and the style of doing business with a lot of people at City Hall is totally opposite.
Yeah.
And so there would be a clash. I think that a department head should be a strong advocate for his department, for his budget, for his people. And I think that good city management understands that, and you can work through that. So. Yeah.
If we can... switch gears a little bit, and obviously this was a horrible event, but if we can take anything positive away from it, one on the outside from a citizen looking at the situation, the way it drew the community together for a common cause, mm-hmm. Was one. What are on the fire side, mm-hmm. What has the industry learned from this, or have they?
Well, from an industry point of view, the lessons are well documented. There are things, there were communication problems that took place. There was smoke conditions that were odd. Probably the biggest lesson learned is that when you're in a desert like this and you have an extended drought, fire behavior can become extremely unpredictable. Dosey Fire was an excellent example of that. I saw the fire go around on the leeward side of the mountain, downhill faster than it went up the side of the mountain on the windward side.
Yeah.
And that's unusual fire behavior. Some of those things sometimes have to be learned by the experience that you get on the job. So from an industry point of view, we can talk about the air support, we can talk about the water, we can talk about the drops, we can talk about the fire conditions, those sorts of things. There's always lessons to be learned on something like this.
Yeah, and have steps been taken? Do you think it's a positive? There's some positive things that have come out. I mean, are they making some strides to protect our guys and gals out there in the field?
I'm sure of it, and I think that this is going to be one of those case studies that will be used for 100 years.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So this is the learning curve will be continual.
Well, a lot of
dissecting and analyzing what happened.
In part, a lot of these things that happened, you can prepare for them, you can know them. I think there were situations that the superintendent saw and recognized and was trying to get away from, but without being there, there was a decision that was made. And second guessing is if he'd have gone this way, it wouldn't have happened. Second guessing is if he'd gone the other way, it wouldn't have happened. But it happened.
Yeah. Now, the Granite Mountain crew was a city entity, correct?
Correct.
And that is unique. In some of my reading, that's not how it normally is. Am I correct in saying that?
That's correct. It was the only hotshot team in the United States that's assigned to a city.
How are they normally done? Is it like through forest departments like a federal or county? What?
State or federal? Yeah, usually, yeah.
Why was that decision made, or was that before you?
Oh, that was way before me. Yeah.
What are the pros of having it city maintained? Of having a hotshot crew city maintained?
Probably the biggest advantage was that they were also used for clearing those areas that are in the interface zone during the off season. When they were during the on season, they brought enough money to pay for actually the off season type work and things like that. That's the advantage. The problem with a with a type 1 incident, hotshot team like that, is that it requires a very, very specialized, focused training on certain things. These people are trained and experts in, oddly enough, how to cut trees,
yeah,
how to cut them down and all those sorts of things. Everybody has a job. And so they're highly specialized. Either the guys that you just point in a direction and they go and they take care of things, yeah, they make their own decisions, other than, you know, the assignment that they're given. They're experts in their field. You lose that expertise. You lose that firefighting capability if you need them here in town.
Yeah.
However, it's possible that they might be in Montana when you had when you, yeah, have a fire here. So there's a lot of arguments over that. So it's a pride of having an organization like that. What they do other than that type of firefighting, their expertise that they bring,
yeah,
that's probably the biggest advantage. The advantage, disadvantage, obviously, is that when things go wrong, it can be very, very costly and difficult.
Yeah, emotionally and financially.
In every way, yeah, yes.
Now, very soon after the events of June 30th, at Prescott High School, there was a large media event where that the investigation report was dissected and, mm-hmm, presented to, mm-hmm, the media and the community.
Mm-hmm.
You were on stage with the other officials. What, and again, it may be a very broad and very obvious question, but what was going through your mind as that report was being basically dissected line by line?
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking as you were hearing that and seeing it on the screen?
Mm-hmm.
What was...
A lot of that I had already seen,
yeah,
so our presence there was more for the support and presence of command staff on the stage. That particular report was based not on, you might say, finding fault as much as lessons learned. And once you start dealing with that part of it, it almost sounds like a cover-up to some people. No, we want specific information. We don't care what the wind was and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah. And so going through that, what went through my mind is that it's not going to satisfy the people that really want solid answers. That's,
yeah,
probably the biggest thing.
Human nature is when something bad happens, we need to have a boogeyman to blame. We need to be able to point a finger and say, it's his fault, their fault, its fault, whatever, mm-hmm, it happens, mm-hmm, to be, whether it be a natural disaster and it's the fault of the ocean, or, mm-hmm, an earthquake, mm-hmm, or an individual. Blame was, again, by that person that we just spoke of who was involved in the investigation, blame was directed towards Marsh, Eric Marsh, and you had some strong words to say on that. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, it goes back to what I mentioned before. It was premature to be saying anything that was that damaging and that specific without all the information. And I thought that was clearly wrong. The families were extremely upset.
Yes.
They don't care about those sorts of things. They might want to know what happened, but I don't know if they care so much about somebody playing the expert from an armchair. That
it's very easy to second guess.
Absolutely.
And third guess and
absolutely,
fifth guess.
Yeah. So that was my response. I was angry and upset that somebody would do that. However, I have no idea. I don't know the person. The person was not important to me other than the fact I thought he was trying to sensationalize,
yeah,
an absolute disaster.
Now, summarize, if you would, the training and expertise that was on the ground there. In your opinion, was everything done that could have been done that day?
I don't know. The reason,
fair
I
enough.
Yeah, I wasn't there, and I wouldn't try to second guess what the incident commanders were doing, or the planning section, or those lapses that took place in between.
Now, November of 2013 was your last day,
mm-hmm,
your last time as chief of Prescott. Look yourself in the mirror and tell us what you see. Do you see somebody who can hold their head high in what you did as a chief before, during, and after this event?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a very firm believer that there's only one way to do things, and that's the right way as you see them now. Other,
yeah,
people might not see it that way, but to me it's a matter of just doing what has to be done.
Yeah.
I
No, go ahead.
I believe in the old idea that if it's not broken, you're not looking hard enough. And so whatever we could take from something like this, you know, I would want to do. Had I stayed, I would want to do more.
Now, let's move forward. I'm looking at that button hanging from your shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Your mayoral run,
mm-hmm.
What prompted that?
Actually, I had thought about, even when I was an interim, I had thought about running for council. I felt like there were some issues that that I could help with, or at least contribute to. When I decided eventually to run for mayor, it was because I feel that the mayor can do more, can be accomplished at the level of a mayor than the level of a city council person.
Now, we talked about, like, San Francisco, very mm-hmm. strong mayor form mm-hmm. of government. Mm-hmm. Others are more of a city manager form of government.
Correct.
What is Prescott?
City manager form.
City manager. City,
yeah. Yeah.
If you are elected, mm-hmm. what can you do? What will you do to better the community, not just in the fire and emergency services, but in the community as a whole?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that you want to be able to address and reinforce?
Mm-hmm. Well, I go back to the training I've had, to the experiences I've had. I've been in executive leadership positions for a long time. I've seen situations come and go. I've worked for city managers. I've worked for strong mayors. I've worked for special districts. So there's a tremendous amount of information there. One thing that I would like to see in any city manager is that he or she become very involved with the community and involved, and at least know their employees and be very visible. That's one of the things that I think is the most important part, with the understanding that the city manager runs the city, not the mayor.
Gotcha.
Not the mayor. City manager runs the city. He does the hiring, the firing. He's the one that brings forward that information that council and mayor deal with. I see myself as a mayor in a system where I am one vote, and I will try to influence with my knowledge, skills, and ability and experience those things that I can. I expect to be out in the community. I think the three biggest priorities I have are going to be to establish trust with the community in our political system. I think it's lacking right now. Establish a higher level of trust and morale with our employees, and let the entire community, the Quad Cities and the reservation as far as that goes, know that the city of Prescott is a participant that wants to become involved in planning and in economic development and anything having to do with this area. What's good for one city is going to be good for other cities.
Yeah.
That's what I hope to do.
The overall Quad City area is right around, I think the last census, about 100,000, a little mm-hmm. over 100,000.
Correct.
The city of Prescott obviously is a part of that, but kind of what happens in Prescott can wag the tail of the rest of the animal, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep that on track and to make sure that what happens within the town and the city limits of Prescott is good for the entire 100,000. You think that's important?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily see it that way, but I see Prescott as being a participant, especially in economic development and planning and those sorts of things. I'm not as concerned that another city might get another Walmart or Kmart or whatever,
yeah.
wherever it might be, as much as I'm concerned that people would come into Prescott for the reasons that Prescott's known for and
yeah.
important, whether it be tourism, whether it be the nightlife, whatever the case might be.
Yeah.
That, to me, the economic engine, I don't think is going to be the powerhouse from Prescott as much as it is from other communities.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned the need for a strong and quality town manager, city manager. Do you care to speculate on, if you are elected, how that role, if it will change?
Well, I've been asked this question, or I've been accused. I've been accused before of running for office so I could fire the city manager, which is really kind of an absurd thing for anybody to say. However, it's coming from people that it's predictable that they would say something that silly. Here's the reality: it takes four votes of the council to hire a city manager. Now, a city manager that would be hired with four votes shouldn't take the job. It should be unanimous. But
yeah.
It takes four votes to hire. If you're going to fire a city manager with cause, it takes five votes. Now, I've been in cities where city managers got in trouble, and they eventually weren't necessarily fired, but they eventually left. And it is so disruptive, it's not worth it. It is not worth it. And to run for an office just to fire somebody is really stupid. Now, what I expect from him or her, I don't care who it is what I just mentioned a few minutes ago. There are people that have got to be involved with the community, with their employees, and run the city and bring those issues to the city council for policy decision making.
So the expectation is for the position, for the job, for the office, not directed at any one individual.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly. I'm sure that Mr. McConnell felt that he was justified, yeah. And I didn't fight it. If that was a decision that was made, I lived with it, and I took the high road. I never sat back and felt sorry for myself. I never blamed anybody. I simply said it was his decision to make, and he made it.
Yeah.
If he's a city manager, when I'm elected mayor, I'll very simply sit down with him and the rest of the council, and here's my expectations. Council, what are your expectations? And then you start going from that point.
Have you had any, and if so, how much dialogue with McConnell since?
Oh, none. I didn't have much before. So.
Now, there are... some people may think that with your background and the public face that people know you of being with emergency services and the fire services, that may be driving your agenda. It may be, like you'd mentioned, mm-hmm. you're running to fire somebody or to get mm-hmm. your point across. Mm-hmm. What do you have to say to those critics that think you're trying to ride in and get a vote based on
public safety?
By mm-hmm. media and riding a wave of I don't want to say popularity, but kind of celebrity in your role.
No, I never thought of myself as a celebrity. I think of myself as somebody that just can't seem to walk away from a problem if it can be fixed. You can't fix a problem if you don't get involved. So as far as celebrity status, I know that I have a lot of name recognition and face recognition, but that's not what started me thinking was way before this incident took place.
You mentioned you were thinking about
council
public office,
yes.
In your interim spot.
Exactly.
Anything that I'll let you get on your soapbox here right now. Mm-hmm. Give us your campaign speech right now. Tell
I
us.
Think I gave it already.
You got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything
no,
that? Oh, go ahead.
Actually, what I want to do is develop trust and to get involved and to be involved with the planning that takes place here. We've got some serious issues to deal with. I'll tell you one thing that I wish would happen, and which would have happened much sooner, is instead of a mayor and council sitting back and deciding what needs to be done based on the history of what's been done, is to sit back and ask the people what they want. You know, I think it's essential that we should sit up there and say, okay, we only have so much money, we have these services, citizens. Now, it's going to take some effort to do this. Citizens, what do you want? You know, what's more important to you, an extra fire engine or an extra something else? In my world, Matt, in my world, there is public safety is not fire and police. And so, therefore, it's not going to be the top priorities for me. In my world, public safety includes public works, your water, your wastewater, your sanitation, all those things that have to do with public health and safety. That's my world. First responders are extremely important, and they're especially important when the bottom falls out.
Yeah.
When the system breaks apart, we need our people to be there as soon as possible, whether it's for health reasons or injuries or fire or drowning or whatever the case might be. We've got an outstanding group of employees here. What we need from our employees is ideas on what they can do better, and things like that. We have to give them a voice.
Gotcha.
I've been accused of being a labor organizer. For goodness sakes, a labor organizer. He wants to bring unions in here. I don't know where these things come from.
If it wasn't for the rumor mill, we wouldn't have any jobs.
The meteorite, you know, had a message on it. This guy's going to form a union or something. It's absurd. You can't have, in the city charter of Prescott, you cannot negotiate with any group, whether union or not. And yet these people are coming up with these absurd notions.
Yeah.
I don't know where the heck it's coming from. But that's what I want to accomplish. I want to talk to the people. I want them to tell me what they want. And if the people want less service because they don't want to pay more money, you gotta listen to the people.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned there's some serious issues. Give me the top three that you think.
Well, the budget.
Budget
right now, yeah.
That's not unique to Prescott, but how budgets are dealt with are definitely unique to the individual communities.
Well, part of the problem with the budget right now is there's a lot of focus being placed on the pensions, okay, fire and police pensions, things like that. But I think a lot of people don't realize that there was a time when the pension system was huge. Now, employers have always put their percentage in, but cities or districts, they don't have to put that, they don't have to match it. They're supposed to match it. They didn't have to match it. So there was a time when there was an enormous amount of money, and so cities would put less money in there, kind of writing an IOU in the future.
Yeah.
And then there was the speculators that took some of that pension money and made bad investments, so that came down. The market crashes. Now we're at a deficit, and the cities that didn't have the reserves have to pay into it.
Yeah.
But it's focused on the employees, not the bad decisions that were made. Now, clearly, there's a lot of people that are in office right now that were not involved with those decisions.
Yeah.
But that's what we inherit. When we run for office, God bless us, what we inherit is all the good and bad of the past.
And that brings up another thought. You in my dealings with you in the past, and especially right here, we've been sitting for a little bit talking, you seem like a logical, well-educated, intelligent person, and you're running for office. That just knocks the socks right out of that argument.
I'd like to start a trend. I've always said that one vote over 50% does not make you any smarter than the one before. And you know, the other thing too is that one vote can make you a politician, but it takes a lifetime to be a proven leader.
Yeah.
And this is what I hope that I can bring, is that my experience in leadership positions. That's what I've done most of my life, actually.
Yeah.
It started happening way before I even understood what leadership was. And so my idea is to bring people together, try to get consensus, try to build something from whatever has to be built with as many people as possible, and make decisions based on that. And in the fire service, my role was to try to get consensus, and if it didn't work, then I made the decision. Can't do that as a mayor. Or shouldn't. Shouldn't do it as a mayor.
Anything that we didn't touch on that you want to discuss? Anything
well,
you want to bring up?
The only thing that I might mention is that I've got a website, and I've got phone number. Yeah, the website is on Facebook. It's just Fryho. Put that in. And as far as the website itself, it's Dan for Mayor, or you can call 928-493-4282, and there will be a message there, and somebody from the campaign committee or myself will contact you.
So good deal.
Facebook.
Can I hold on to that?
Absolutely.
I'll scan it in and post it up.
Oh, okay, that would be great.
And we'll have links to this on the site. I was explaining to Bob over here in the monkey gallery, in the peanut gallery. I am the most non-political person you'll ever meet. I think anybody who runs for office is bananas.
Go ahead and say
crazy.
Bananas.
I was trying to clean it up. As we've said before, this is a family broadcast. But I find it fascinating, and I find politics fascinating and frustrating all at the same time.
Absolutely, I do too.
I do not envy anybody who runs for office.
My entire career as a public servant has been apolitical. And that's what I am. That's how I don't see myself as a politician. I see myself as somebody that provided service all my career. And to jump into this area, into this arena, is not only it's fascinating. It's fascinating. It's I'm not
just one word
of,
for it.
I'm not to the point of frustration yet. Although I've been ruined. I'm getting ready to talk to a mayor in the area here, and he says, "Oh, sure, come on by anytime." He says. I don't think he knew if I was going to run yet. And he says, what do you want to talk about? I said, well, some of the local issues. He says, why? I said, well, I'm running for the mayor of Prescott. He says, have you considered a lobotomy first?
Then you can get a job in journalism if you get that.
If I'd have thought fast enough, I'd have said, yeah, I did.
That's why I'm here.
I had one. That's
so, anything else? We good?
No, that's it. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk candidly about some of these issues. I hope that listeners appreciate that I will always come from the truth and from the heart.
And you had said that you are up for any interview and sitting down and
anytime.
And obviously that's the case because you're sitting down with me, and I'm about as low on the totem pole as you can get. Thanks.
I guess only other thing I could say is I need money for the campaign.
Well, you haven't finished your coffee yet. Otherwise, we can walk around and pass the cup to the folks here.
Just dump it on the floor. Thank you so much.
All right, hey, thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're devastated. We just lost 19 of some of the finest people you'll ever meet. I mean, right now we're in crisis. I hope my demeanor now does not represent how we all feel. It just happens to be the job that I have at the moment. But truly, we're going through a terrible crisis right now. Well, if you ever met them, you'd meet some of the finest, most dedicated people. These are the guys that'll go out there with 40, 50 pounds of equipment and walk 5 miles. They'll sleep out there as they try to develop fire lines and put protection between homes, natural resources, and still try to remain safe. These are quality people.